I think we're going to see something very, very important and very beautiful about Megillat Esther, and that's really central to understanding what the Megillah is about and what Purim is about. And it's something that's very relevant to life in general, in my opinion. Let's start with the following. The first perek, a significant part of it, presents a fascinating story, but one that is given to us in tremendous detail, where the details don't seem to have a lot to do with everything else. In other words, we have this whole discussion about the gender wars between the men and women of Paras Umadai, which is all very fascinating and all that, and makes for interesting reading. But aside from that, the question, well, what does that have to do with anything? In other words, the issue of, I understand that Ahasuerus being angry at Vashti and replacing her with Esther, that's very important for the storyline. That I understand. That's very important for the Nes of Purim. I understand that. But all of the stuff about Liot Kol Ish Sorer Beveito and V'chon Hashem Yitnu Yikar Levalehem, right? That stuff, as interesting and fascinating as it is, doesn't seem to have a lot to do with the Nes of Purim, right? And what the Megillah is about. Why is that here? And that's not one of the questions so much that I want to raise. I have about five questions I want to raise. But just as an introductory point, it's interesting that we have a lot of information here that, again, on the surface seems to be irrelevant. But if you look more closely at the Megillah, it actually is central, it's fundamental to everything in the Megillah, because what it really sets up is a context, and it sets up a model for the rest of the interactions between the major characters in the Megillah. Okay? In other words, if I refer you to diagram A over here, okay, on the whiteboard, if we take a look, and forgive me, I'm laughing at my drawing now, your comment. It's just a reflection of how bad and hard it is to have. It's okay, the rest of my family makes up for it. What this is supposed to be, and I know you can't tell, but it's just a representation, okay? You can pull in any other member of my family from the baby on up through Gula. They'll do a great job. I can't. I'm not the artist in the family. But this is my attempt at representing a bird's eye view of a platform, a stage, okay, with two sets of footprints on it. Okay. Okay. So imagine looking down, right, onto the stage. The stage represents the Megillah, and those two sets of footprints, that's Ahasuerus and that's Vashti. Okay? Now, what happens throughout the entire Megillah, isn't that obvious? Let's speak for itself. It's modern art. What's the matter? You don't appreciate art? Okay, the point is that this represents the relationship between Vashti and Ahasuerus. And if you follow the entire Megillah, you'll see, and we're going to go through this together over the next few minutes, that the entire Megillah consists of every one of the major characters being in one, let's like, you know, actors stepping onto the stage and stepping into one of those sets of footprints. Okay, and that's a good way of summarizing the whole Megillah on one level. Okay, let me show you what I mean by that. And the language that's used is very, very interesting. The language that's used throughout the entire Megillah, okay, is based on the language in the first parak. Okay. Now remember, I told you to watch the relationships between the major characters. Okay, I'm not pulling this out of left field. You looked at this during Hachana, so hopefully you've seen some of this already, if not all of it. Let's take a look for a moment and see how this plays out. So Perak Aleph, okay? Perak Aleph. We're going to start with Pasuk Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud and Yud Aleph. We read about how the king, how Ahasuerus, character number one, Ahasuerus, asked Vashti, orders Vashti to come to this mishteh, and she refuses. She refuses in Pasuk Yud Bet, V'tam'eina malka Vashti lavo b'dvar melech asher b'yad asarisim. She refuses this royal command. Okay, this is the royal decree. She refuses it. V'ksov ha'melech ma'ov v'chamato ba'aravo. Right? His anger burns within him. And take careful note of the language. The language is going to come back to haunt us. Okay? And in Pasuk Yud Chet, after discussion about the consequences of this action, finally, they tell Achashverosh, "Vayom azeh tamar sarok parasim adai asher shamu et divrei hamal et divar malka lechol sarei hamelech ukedai vizayon vakatza." Again, notice the words; they're going to be important. And therefore, imal melech tovi etzei divar malchut lefanav ikatei b'datei parasim adai v'lo yavor asher lo tavo v'ashdi lufnei hamelech Achashverosh umalchuta yiten hamelech ruta hatava mimena. Pasuk which hopefully is familiar to us all. Pasuk Chav, v'nishma pitkam ha-melech asher yaseh b'chol malchuto ki rabahi, v'chol anashim yitnu yikar l'valehem, and therefore, the consequence of his decree against Vashti should be that all of the women in the kingdom give yikar, give honor to l'valehem, to their husbands, l'migadol v'akaton. V'itav ha-davar b'inei ha-melech v'asarim v'yas ha-melech kidvar mimuchan. Okay? Vaishlach Svarim al Kom Dinot Hamelach Amdinam Dinah Kichtava Vel Am Va'am Kilshono Liyot Kol Ish Sorer Beveito. Okay, each man should rule in his bayit Umedaber Kilshon Amo. Okay, that's the first parak. Okay, now watch what happens as we begin to read the rest of the Megillah. So, I suggested that throughout the Megillah, the major characters step into and actually struggle over which shoes they're going to be into. They step into these shoes, these footprints, throughout the Megillah. Let's start with a couple of examples from the beginning of the Megillah. Okay? And some of it's very, very obvious. You'll see. It really, once you stop to think about it, it's so clear that this is going on. For example, who steps into the shoes of Vashti? Clearly Esther, right? Esther replaces Vashti, right? That's self-evident. Vashti, right, is replaced by Esther. So, first example of this phenomenon that I'm suggesting is right there in front of us. And who is constantly trying to take over the footprints, who's trying to step into the shoes of, there we go, Haman, right? So we start right away, the beginning, so we have Esther is placed, whether she likes or not, is placed into the shoes of Vashti, and right, and of course Haman is trying to take over stepping into the shoes of Achashverosh. And what is the concrete symbol, what's the icon of this taking over the place of Achashverosh? What is the physical object that represents the identity of Achashverosh? Tabat. Beautiful Tabat. Okay. And while we're on the subject of Tabat, by the end of the Megillah, where is the Tabat? Mordechai. Right? So that, I see what I'm saying about the identity stepping into the shoes, how there's a struggle between Haman and Mordechai, who's in the shoes of Achashverosh. Another physical example of the identity of the king. What's another, or a cluster actually, a whole group of things that are associated with the identity of the king? What? Ah, we're looking, excellent. I meant something physical for it, but okay, let's take a look at that. So, if you look in Perek Gimel, right, Haman is ordering people in general, and specifically Mordechai, to bow down to him, to accept his subjugation. This is exactly what Achashverosh tried to do to Vashti. It is a royal decree. That's the whole point of it, right? Why? Not stam, because Haman was, a tough guy. Right? This is a royal order. Just as Vashti was given a royal order, so is Mordechai. Mordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachavet, and Mordechai does what? Exactly what Vashti did, namely to refuse it. In other words, we start off the essence, the basic part of the story, and where the story, you know, really gets underway in Perek Gimel with Esther and Mordechai in Vashti's shoes and Haman in Achashverosh's shoes. Right? Clear enough? And just to continue with what you were saying, what is the reaction? Pasuk Hey. Vayar Haman ki Mordechai korei mishachavelo vayimale Haman chema. Right? Where do we recognize that from? The same language that we had before in Perek Aleph. And again, the next Pasuk Hey. Vayivez be'inav. What did it say in Perek Aleph? Ukedai vizayon Bakatzaf, right? The same language is used. And of course, we see over here, Pasuk Yud, we have the removal of the ring is given to Haman, etc. What else shows that Haman is trying to take over the identity of Achashverosh? What are the physical objects?
The clothing.
Beautiful. The Levush, right? The Levush Malchut and the Sus and the Keter Malchut, which Haman intends, right? He's the one who suggests there would be a good idea for this person to have all these things. Of course, the person he has in mind is clearly himself, we're told. And in the end, it turns out that Haman isn't the one, but rather Mordechai. Okay, that's the beginning. Now, as the plot thickens, what happens? There's a struggle over who's standing in which position, who is occupying which position, who is the Achashverosh and who is the Vashti, right? And slowly, this kind of wrestling match in which the tables are turned and Esther and Mordechai move into Achashverosh's shoes. We saw already the Tabaat, right, as an example much later in the story. And Haman is forced into the position of Vashti. And let's take a look at a few examples of that, okay? One of my favorites. When Esther wants to get rid of Haman, right? Esther wants to eliminate Haman. What's the first thing that she does to Haman? What's her first move? Hear that? Isn't that fascinating? Why is that significant? What's the downfall of Vashti, right? How does Vashti eliminate it? Because she's invited, all begins with being invited to a party, right? You see where Esther got that idea from, right? It comes right out of the playbook from Perek Aleph. Or, for example, right? Now we get to, remember we talked about those things that seem to be out of place. Why are we talking about V'chol Nashim Yitnu Yikar Levaleihem, Liyo Kol Ish Sorer Beveito? So one of the very interesting things about the Megillah, Mordechai is consistently referred to, he's sometimes called Mordechai, but how? Sometimes Yudi, but he's most often called, he's called many, many, many times, what's he called? There's something else that he's called an incredible number of times from the very first time he's introduced. As a matter of fact, when he's first introduced, it doesn't say more. Let's say again and again, Ish, right? Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan habira, right? Ki ha'ish Mordechai holech v'gadol. Throughout the Megillah, what does Haman have to say about Mordechai as he rides him through the city again and again? What does he keep on saying? Kacha yaseh la'ish. What's the root of the word yikaro? Bikaro? What's the shoresh? Yikar. And what does it say in Perek Aleph? B'chol hanashim yitnu yikar leva'alehem. Right? B'chol hanashim yitnu yikar leva'alehem mikaton v'agadol. And that's exactly, and that the katon gadol, by the way, also comes up in the Megillah. But v'chol anashim yitnu yikar levalehem, that's exactly what Haman is forced to do to Mordechai when Haman thought that just the opposite would take place. Right? See, it all goes back to that dynamic between Achashverosh and Vashti. That's the paradigm for all the relationships. It's either one or the other. Okay? Everyone is either an Achashverosh or a Vashti, and depending on where in the story, right, we have either Haman is the Achashverosh and Mordechai and Esther are the Vashti, or the other way around. Okay? And so that's us. If you look in Perek Aleph, right, the lesson as far as they're concerned in Perek Aleph of the interaction between Vashti and Mordechai, right? What's the bottom line? Number one, b'chol anashim yitnu yikar levalehem, right? That Vashti should be a model of how it's necessary for the wives to give yikar to their husbands. And that's what that's what Haman wants to be done to him, right? He wants to get the yikar, but instead what happens? Kacha yasel isha shamel chafes bikaro is what Haman has to do for Mordechai. So Haman is being forced into the Vashti role vis-a-vis the Achashverosh role of Mordechai. Because a couple of sukkim later we read Liyot kol ish sarer beveto umedaber bilshon amo. In other words, that Liyot kol ish, that each ish is going to be sarer beveto. And what happens? Mordechai is described again and again for this reason as the ish, right? Mm-hmm. And what happens to him ultimately? He ends up ruling over what bayit? What bayit does he rule over? Beit Haman, right? It says in the end of Megillah that Beit Haman is given in the hands of Mordechai, who's the Ish.
Okay, and that's
Sorer. Sorer means from the word time, means to be the ruler over.
Okay, the which ish is because the women were supposed to give yakar to their husband.
Liyot kol Ish Sorer Beito, Pasuk Chav Bet. Good? Okay. These things that look so superfluous, so tangential to the story of the Megillah, these psukim of, you know, from, you know, Yud-Chet through Chabet, actually form the foundation of the framework for the interaction between Haman and Mordechai and Esther throughout the Megillah. So there's a struggle over who's going to have which position. Okay? That's a central idea in the Megillah. And there are many, many, many examples. We went through some of them. But the point is that we start off with Haman trying to take the role of Achashverosh, threatening the Vashti of Mordechai and Esther. And by the end of the story, right, midway or so, it turns around and instead, occupying the place of Achashverosh, we have Mordechai and Esther. Esther with the big day Malchut, Mordechai with the big day Malchut, and so on and so on, right? All these things, the Tabat, and what happens is that instead, Haman ends up as the Vashti, and of course, he, like Vashti, is eliminated, and that's central to everything that happens here. Okay, so we're almost up to point one. Therefore, why is it significant? Well, it's significant on a certain level because a key idea throughout the Megillah, it's a concept that is articulated in Perek Tet, right? In Perek Tet, Pasuk Aleph, it's the very bottom of the second side. We're not quite up to there, but we'll fast forward for a second. Uvishneim asar chodesh uchorosh adar b'shoshah asar yom bo asher igiyah dvar melech v'dato le'asot b'yom asher sivru oivei ha'yudim asar lishlot b'hem v'nahafochu asher yishlotu ha'yudim hem ha'besonehem. Okay? This concept of v'nahafochu, we see it again and again and again. Again, there's so many examples. We went through a tiny, tiny bit. You can take a look and see throughout here, you'll see the Mishtat Yayin comes back, of course, the idea major aspect of the Vinavochu is, of course, in Parag Zayin, Pasukud, Vayitlu et Haman, ala Eitz Asher Yichin L'Mordechai, B'chamat Mel Shachach, right, how they trade places. If you take a look in Parag Chet, you'll see the Beit Haman several times, the Tabat, and Perek Tet Pasuk Dal Ki Gadol Mordechai Beveit HaMelech V'Shamo Holech B'Chol HaYudim Ki Ha'ish Mordechai Holech B'Gadol. Of course, this is the Liyot Kol Ish Sarer Beveit Tov. I'm sure they're all together in this Pasuk. Okay, so the Megillah tells us that this idea of Benahavokul, right, that's said explicitly in the Megillah in Perek Tet. But it's not just that it's stated that, okay, we see this, you know, reversal of fortune that takes place. What I tried to show you just now, over these last few minutes, was a glimpse of the degree to which this is the basic fabric of the whole Megillah, right? In other words, what hopefully you saw is the degree to which the V'Nafoch idea runs throughout the entire Megillah. Okay? You want to see what I'm getting at there? Yes? How the entire Megillah, starting from Perek Aleph, is built on the same basic building blocks, but the difference between the beginning and the end is how it's put together, right? You have the eights, and you have Mordechai, and you have Haman, and the question is, who's on top and who's on the bottom? You have the Sus and the Keter Malchut and all of that. And the question is who's pulling who? You have, for example, the role of the Vashti and the role of the Achashverosh. And the question is who's in the role of Achashverosh, who's in the role of Vashti, right? And that's this idea of Anafahu, that the basic components are the same throughout the Megillah, but the Nafahu. Okay. Now, I don't think that that's at all a chiddush. Maybe we took it a little bit further in terms of examples. The basic idea we should all be familiar with, I'm sure, and not a chiddush, not meant to be a chiddush. But I want to ask a simple question. Why? Why is that important? Why is that such an important idea to stress in the Megillah, the idea of an Avahu? Why is that so central? Why is that the basic fabric of Megillat Esther? That's question number one, okay? Question number one is, I just want to understand why this concept of V'Nafochu, what's the point, okay? Okay, question number two. By the way, that's the longest of them. The rest are very short. And they all have one answer, so we'll do it very quickly. Okay. Question number two. So I want to understand, Esther goes to great lengths, puts her life in danger. She's very hesitant to do so. She finally agrees. Esther succeeds, and she gets Achashverosh to send out this letter, and that's the beginning of the Yeshua, right? She sends out this letter, and the horsemen go running full speed to spread the word and to pass on this letter, which is crucial, right? This is the key to everything, this letter. So I want to ask a simple question. What did it say in the letter? What is it that that letter did? Why is it that that letter helped? What is it that Achashverosh gave Esther in that proclamation? So let's go through possibilities. If we didn't know the story, we might say, well, maybe he gave them an army to fight for them. Yes, it says that in the letter. Well, okay, so, but first I want to know, does it say anything about giving them an army?
No.
Protection? Weapons? Maybe money so that they could buy weapons? Does it say that now there was a royal decree that they couldn't be attacked? That would be nice, right? That would be helpful, that Haman and his people couldn't attack us. Does it say anything about that in the letter?
I
can't revoke the previous letter. I can't do that. So what does it say? So what is in the letter? Yeah?
Isn't it just that it shows that the king is on our side, and then why would we dare start the nation that people saw that? There's no other word.
Okay. So you're saying that it shows that the king is on their side. Okay. Okay. Right. Of course, the king was just on the other people's side, so the question is how much that's... But I hear, okay. But is there anything like mamashi, anything that they got in that? Said that they could fight. They could fight. No, they could fight. And if we didn't have permission to fight? They're coming to kill out everybody. It's not cute that we think that maybe we'll be saved, right? We know, they say very clearly that the plan is to kill out everybody. So, l'chora, we're going to fight, right? There's no choice. And then, permission, not permission. So, we say please first before we're about to all be wiped out. So, the second question, and it could be, we'd say the fact that it's shows that the king is on your side is certainly something, but I think nonetheless it's fair to ask the, you know, Igeret that is said, that the Igeret that, what is the meaning of it? What's the significance of it? How does it help us? Okay? That's question number three. I'm sorry, question number two. Question number three. I told you, after number one, they're all quick questions. Question number three. So is the answer. Question number three. Question number three is, the holiday is called Purim. And Megillah tells us why it's called Purim. Al Shem HaPur. Okay? Because Haman cast these lots. Now, if you had never heard of Purim, you never read the Megillah, and someone would come and tell you a synopsis of the miracle of Purim, and then said, okay, you know, imagine a Sunday school, have kids who never heard about Purim, they don't know anything about this, and you go and you're teaching them the basic story of Purim, at the end, you finish telling them the whole story of Purim, say, okay, we now have a project for you kids to do. Here's the project. I want you to pick a name for the holiday that commemorates the events that we just learned about, right? You just told them the whole story, beginning to end, everything, including Haman casting lots, Esther, Vashti, the war, everything. You told them the whole story. You come to the end, you say, okay, kids, what are you going to name the holiday? Is anyone going to name it Purim? It's crazy, right? It's no sense. It's like this insignificant detail that, like, you know, I'd rather name it Hamantash, right? What kind of name is that? You know, like the holiday of wine, if you want. I mean, that's a prominent part of the story. I don't know. It's just a strange thing. What about the Yom Tov of, you know, defeating Amalek? What about being saved from Haman? The fact that the Jewish people, there's so many things to talk about. So many things that represent the essence of the miracle. Because he cast lots? That's what's important? And if he had just gone to the calendar and said, you know, oh, let's see, Adar's a nice month, you know, it's relatively nice weather, it's not too hot, not too cold, and, you know, okay, let's see, when's there a free day? Yud Gimel Adar, right? We've changed the story. I think you mentioned it in the story, but that's the essence of Purim, that we call it Purim, right? Why is that? And the fourth question is a corollary to the third, but it says in the Megillah, this is really wild. It says in the Megillah that Mordechai, you know, what did he do? He peeled poor hu hagoral, right? It translates the word poor for us, because after all, poor is a foreign word. So it translates, what's a poor? Poor is a goral. Very nice. It doesn't translate it once, you may have noticed as you went through the Megillah. It translates it twice, right? In Perek Gimel and Perek Tet. So the Gemara Megillah on Daf Yud Chet, we have a discussion amongst Amoraim, and one says to the other that they're talking about people who don't speak Hebrew and how they yotze the Megillah, right? And one of them says to the other, how are people who don't understand Hebrew, how they yotze the Megillah? He says, what do you mean people who don't understand Hebrew? Forget about people who don't understand Hebrew. Atu hachashranim b'nei ramachim anan mi'adinan, right? Do we, so speaking about themselves, about the Amoraim, do we know what Achashtaranim B'nei HaRamachim are? Right? In other words, there are a lot of foreign words in the Megillah. Right? Who knows what Achashtaranim means? Right? And we know from context, we know from Mepharshim, whatever. But I'm saying, but it's not Kilo we speak Persian, right? And there are a lot of foreign words. Most of them, there are a lot of foreign words in the Megillah. So, and none of them are translated. And poor is translated not once, but twice. So I don't know. I think that if it was translated in Perek Gimel, that's good enough. I could remember it till Perek Tet. It's not such a long Megillah, right? And instead of, you want to translate, you only have two translations, you know, that's your quota. So translate poor once and translate Achashtaranim once, so that the poor Amoraim will know what the word means. Why should we translate poor twice and there, and other words we don't translate at all? Right? That's a fair question.
Where is it translated the second time?
Same time as in Perek Tet. First time as in Perek Gimel. If I remember correctly.
Both times is Goral.
That's correct, right? So why would we be told twice? I got it the first time. Right. Chazar, the source for Chazar. That's it. Okay, that's why we have finals. Okay, Beseder. And question five is a little question. I mean, five, call it five, but it's a minor question. But, you know, that is some question. Why is she called Esther throughout the Megillah? Why not call her by her proper name? Right? I call her Hadassah. Memory serves, she's called Hadassah how many times in the Megillah?
Once.
She's always called Esther. Esther is her Persian name. Why is she not called Hadassah? Which, of course, leads us to the question of what Esther means. We'll get back to that in just a little bit.
Wait, what are you just saying? Hadassah is her Hebrew name, and Esther is her Persian name.
Yeah, and you just call
Esther. Esther is a Persian name?
For sure.
So everyone named Esther is just a Persian name?
No, she's not. She's a Hebrew name.
But, yeah,
it comes to the word Ishtar. Isn't it Ishtar?
So it's related ultimately to the word for the word for star. Okay? There are midrashma, but that's the basic meaning of it. It's original. And for the book of Dot Mikra, you'll see where it comes from, and like to Easter and star, etc. So that's what Esther.
But it wasn't like a Hebrew name until
Mordecai is also a Persian name. Moshe is an Egyptian name. Moshe is Egyptian.
No, Mordecai has a really nice meaning in Hebrew.
Yeah, but it means Mordecai.
But that's a midrash interpretation. That's not the basic. Okay. So we're going to talk about Mordecai. Let's talk about Esther a little bit. Okay. And number six. Here's the key question. If you know the answer to number six, you know the answer to all of these. Okay? With a little bit of explanation. Let's go over. Number six is, why did Haman cast lots? Okay, now I don't want to embarrass anyone, so don't answer. This is because this is on my list of questions you can ask.
Why what?
Good yeshiva education, they'll get wrong. So don't answer. I don't want anyone to get embarrassed. But let me tell you what the standard answer is. The standard answer, you go and ask someone, why did Haman cast lots? And they will almost always answer you, in order to pick the day. Right? In order to pick the best day for killing the Jews. So you cast lots. Okay? The only problem is that's not what it says in the Megillah. And you all just read the Megillah. So who remembers? Just study the Megillah now. Why did Haman cast lots? What? Doesn't say? Take a look at Perek Tet Pasuk Chaf Dalet. I'm sorry. Chaf Dalet. Perek Tet Pasuk Chaf Dalet. That's exactly why it casts lots. Chaf Dalet. That's the correct answer. Ki Haman ben Hamdata Hagagi Tzorer Kol Yudim Chishav Al Yudim LeAbdam. He wanted to destroy the Jewish people, and therefore, what did he do? V'pil Pur Hu Agoral. This is the second time we have the Hu Agoral, right? Lihumam ulAbdam. Okay, in order to Lihumam LeAbdam is what's called a Hindiades. Please don't ask me to spell it. A Hindiades. Okay, Hindiades is where you have a pair of words, this and that, but they're not like two separate independent things, but together they're like one thing, they work together.
What's it called?
Okay? A Hindiades.
Hindiades?
It's not I'm trying to keep it from you or anything. I'm, still, I'm a horrible speller when it comes to, you know, like three or four letter words. You know what? For me to try to spell Hindiades? Come on. What?
Oh, I think we did it with Hindiades in one time.
Okay, so there you go.
Okay.
What? The pair of words where they're not connected by an and, but they're not two separate things. but they work together. Okay? Pachorit, that's the basic idea. In any case, it's not crucial. I mean, just one. And what is one humam left on? So I think the pshat is like this. You have to understand. And this is the essence of the whole Megillah and the whole Purim, as far as I'm concerned. So I want to share it with you, and then you can judge for yourselves. But I think this is the answer to all the questions that we raised. Haman wants to wipe out the Jewish people. But Haman does not want a war, because wars are not good. Right? You fight a war, you have losses. You even run the risk of losing. Right? It's not good. You don't want to have a war. Wars are not good. Ah, what Haman wants to have is a nice little massacre. That's much better. Right? You have a massacre, so it's all gain, no loss, as opposed to a war. Obviously, I'm speaking from his perspective. I don't mean this personally. The point is that Haman wants to go in and wipe out the Jews. He doesn't want to have a war against, war with the Jews. He doesn't want to have to fight against people who are fighting back. So what does Haman do? And listen to the evil genius. Like many of the Rishonim throughout history, there's a chachma to it. It's a terrible, it's an abuse, it's a misappropriate chachma. The chachma. Haman says, I want to kill out all the Jews. What do I need to do? I need to create a psychological framework. I need to create a psychological state and mode in which the Jews are not going to fight back, in which they're just going to, we're going to be able to go in and just slaughter them. Now, how do you do that? So look what Haman does. He peel pur hu ha goral luhumam l'avdam. What does the word goral mean? What's the word goral mean besides lot? It means fate, right? This is your destiny, it's your fate. He was saying to them, I'm not going to choose a day for a war and I'm going to go in and attack you. I'm going to divine in the stars. I'm going to look at your fate, at your goral. I'm going to cast lots to determine what your future is, what your destiny is, what your fate is. And, look, the poor came out that you're going to be destroyed. And Yud Gimel Adar, that's what the poor decrees. And that's why it says, he peel poor hua goral. It's not a translation, it's an explanation. It's telling us the significance of the poor. People took these things very seriously. Just as even today, some people take their horoscopes very, very seriously. And the point is that this was, it was a kind of divination. It was a kind of, and the point was to say, this is what your destiny is. This is your fate. But he does more than that. He sends out these official, right, these super official royal horsemen who go running throughout the entire empire with the most official decree signed and sealed by the king. Even the king can't revoke it. Right? This is the most official document you can have. And all the streets, all the cities, all the communities are filled with people going and reading this official declaration. And what does it say? On Yud Gimel Adar, the Jews are going to be wiped out. You know what it does? You open up a situation where you open up the radio, you turn on the TV, you look on the internet, you open up the newspaper, and all you see is about how everyone's predicting that on Yud Gimel Adar, the Jews are going to be wiped out. What kind of a mindset does that create? Right? Especially in conjunction with the poor. And therefore, what happens? Va'ir Shushan, what does it say? Va'ir Shushan, Navocha, right? They're at a loss. They're paralyzed because they feel like it's a hopeless situation. There's nothing you can do. This is their fate. There's nothing that can be done about it. That's Hipil Pur Hua Goral. Why? Lehumam, the word mehuma, confusion, right? Ula Abdam, and thereby to destroy them. Haman's plan was not simply physical, it was also, and wasn't only political, it was also psychological. Luhumam Ula Abdam, to create a state of confusion, a state of a psychological paralysis, and thereby La Abdam to destroy them.
Without
Luhumam, the word Mihuma, confusion. I don't think that it was that he was looking for what their fate really was. He would want to, this was an advertising campaign, right, by Haman. And the point is, that was successful, right, by Ir Shushan Navocha. His plan was luhumam ulabdam, and indeed that's exactly what happened. Everyone was paralyzed. Everyone felt they couldn't do anything. Even Esther, for a long time, was in that situation. But she felt there was nothing she could do. Yeah.
Could that have happened before, though, if you would have just said, on this day you will be killed?
But we find many times there, the more this is done on, many dimensions, the more effective it is. I'm not saying that he couldn't have done without the poor, but the poor was a very central part of what he was doing, because it was to create a sense that it was another way, besides the decree that was going around, this official decree and everything, it was to create the impression that, like, on many different levels, on a political level, on a mystical level, etc., that this was their destiny and there's nothing you could do about it, right? And different people are going to respond to different things, right? Different things are going to have an effect on different segments, and he wants to hit everything. And watch what happens. Esther and Mordechai get Ahasuerus to send out another letter. And that second letter doesn't give us anything tangible that we didn't have before, but it changes the mindset. Because now what is everyone hearing? What is the word that's being spread throughout the street? What's the official decree? What are these horsemen running through town? What are they reading now? The Jews are going to gather together. They're going to fight back. They're going to avenge themselves against their enemy. Lemaisa, what did we have now that we didn't have before? The answer is nothing. But in terms of, I'm saying, in practical terms, we don't have anything. But on a psychological level, it turned the tide. And instead of Ba'ir Shushan Navocha, what do we have? Ba'ir Shushan, Salav Samecha. Now they're energized. Now they're ready to go. Now they feel, okay, let's go. We're ready. We can do it. There is something we can do. It is realistic that we can go and fight back. And that's what they do. And that's why that second letter turns the tide. The idea of Benafochu is a very powerful one, because what it tells us, I believe, is a very, very important hashkafic idea. This is the essence of the whole story. There are certain things in life, and this is where it becomes important, not just on a national level, as in terms of Jewish history and Jewish destiny, so it's also important on a very personal level, because I think that this is something that affects each and every one of us. That there are certain things in life that are destiny. There are certain things that are fate. There are certain things that we have no control over. Right? I can't decide that, you know what, I was born with talents A, B, C, and I don't have D, F, and I want to trade. Right? I want to suddenly become very... I want to be able to sing beautifully. It's not going to happen. I just wasn't born, that's the way it is. Everyone is born with certain talents, with certain limitations. They're born into a certain family, into a certain community, into a certain... there are certain events that happen in their lives that are problems, challenges, difficulties, opportunities. Right? All kinds of different things. And one person's challenges are not another person's challenges, and one person's opportunities are not another person's opportunities. And we don't get to pick and choose them necessarily, right? In many, many cases, we don't get to choose them. Mordechai and Esther and Am Yisrael didn't get to choose whether or not there was going to be a 13th of Adar, right? They didn't get to choose whether it was going to be a tree, Gavoh Hamishim Ama, and a Haman, and a Sus, and a Levush, and a Keter Malchut, and a Tabat. All the basic building blocks, right? All the basic components are Goram. They're all given... and there are nothing you can do about it. But, says the Megillah, v'nafochu. It's true. The opportunities, the challenges, the raw material, the basic building blocks, right? The Legos that life is made of, that's given to us. And we don't get to say, well, I want that piece and not that piece. That's it. That's what we have. But how they're put together. True, Mordechai and Esther, it's fate that they're going to meet at the Eitz Gavoh Hamishim Ama. But who is hanging whom? Well, that Mordechai and Esther have control over, depending on what they do, and in Siyata Dishmaya, and their bravery, and their intelligence, and their courage, and the choices they make, v'chulei v'chulei. B'nei Yisrael and their enemies are going to meet on the 13th of Adar and fight it out. But who is killing whom? And whether this is the destruction of Am Yisrael or the greatest Hatzalah, well, that's a detail that, v'nafochu, right? How it's put together. And that's the essential point of the Megillah. That's why Purim is so important, because Purim is a refutation of what of the theory that Haman tried to foist on us. Haman tried to say to us, it's all go wrong. You have no choice. You have no, that's it. This is your destiny. This is what's written in the stars. This is what the lottery say. This is what the official proclamations. It can't be changed. It can't be altered. Done. You're finished. And what does Purim tell us? V'nafalchu. That's true of the basic components. That's true of we don't get to choose necessarily which challenges and which opportunities. But what we do with those challenges and opportunities, right? How it's put together, who wins, you know, whether I win or lose this particular challenge, opportunity, problem, whatever, that is given to a large degree into our hands. And we can do a lot about that. And that's why Purim is such a time of simcha. Because when you realize that you have control of your own destiny, when you realize that there's something you can do about what the final script of your life is, that's a tremendous source of simcha. That's by Ir Shushan Salam Samecha. And just add, and I know we're going to drop over time, we're going to conclude momentarily. I just have to wrap it up very quickly. I think that we've gone through all of these points except for one, and that is Esther, right? Perhaps what Megillah is telling us is that sometimes we think that our fate is written in the stars, that there's this idea, we have our destiny, our horoscope, our future written out for us in the way that the laws of nature, the laws of history, the laws of life dictate, and it's, you know, it's all a watch that's wound up and goes, and that's it. And what the Megillah tells us is that ultimately our fate was not written by the celestial stars, but by the human stars, right? Particularly Esther, that she was the star who wrote the destiny of herself and of Am Yisrael, not the celestial stars that Haman pointed to in the Pil Pur Hu HaGoral. I think that Esther is a counterpoint to the theory of Haman, at least the theory that he was trying to promulgate in the Megillah. And I think, as I'm going to conclude, I think that if we look at the story of the Megillah, it's a beautiful paradigm for each and every one of us. It's the idea that we have to realize that although there are so many things in life that are given to us, good, bad, or neither good nor bad, but just the way it is, in terms of who we are and what our situations are, etc., that it's a very, very big mistake to think that, you know, he peel poor hua goral, and that it's very important to remember that that there's this concept of anafohu, where we have a tremendous tremendous input into the final writing of the story of our lives, and that all too often people say, you know, well, you know, what do you expect? I would, you know, this is my circumstance, that's my circumstance, this is, you know, I have these limitations, those limitations, these, you know, whatever it is. And to a certain degree that's true, and to a certain degree, a very important degree, it's not true. To a certain degree there's a concept of Yipil Pur Hu HaGoral, but much more importantly there's the concept of Anafohu. And I think it's really the essence of the story of Megillah and the story of Purim. So I wanted to share that. I think it's has relevance to all of us on a hashkafic level, above and beyond, trying to understand what's going on in the Megillah. Yeah, I think it's a central thread that runs through the Megillah, but I think it has ramifications above and beyond that. That's why we're doing it in this context, and not just Assam. It's just an excursion into Tanakh. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's why I wanted to particularly do this.